Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Monday, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the HD View. This is Melissa Biliardi, your host, and tonight our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. When you call in, press 1 to listen, and or we'll cue you into the show if I can get to the screening room. Please tell all your friends and family about Help for HD and the HD View. Sorry. Click follow on your on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. We are literally at 14,200 listeners now. So thank you all out there for your support and interest in Help for HD programming. Huntington's disease, HD, is a hereditary and terminal disease which destroys neurons in the brain and slowly diminishes the affected person's ability to walk, talk, and reason. In time, they will rely completely upon others for everything. HD devastates entire families emotionally, psychologically, socially, and economically, generation after generation. Every child of someone with HD has a 50% chance of inheriting the gene mutation. Juvenile Huntington's disease, JHD, is a more rapid and virulent form of the disease. They experience many additional traumatic symptoms like decline in scholastics, adverse behavior, seizures, dystonia, and other severe and painful conditions. Our JHD warriors need much, much more support and resources. Our incredible special guest tonight is the esteemed Dr. Paul Machowski. He was born in Montreal, Canada, got his PhD in biological structure at University of Washington in Seattle, then moved to Munich, Germany, where he was a postdoctoral fellow at the Ulrich Hartl and at the Max Planck Institute of Biochemistry. Then he returned to Seattle for a second postdoctoral stint with Stanley Fields in the Department of Genomic Sciences at the University of Washington. In 2001, he was appointed as the assistant professor in the Department of Pharmacology, also at the University of Washington. And then in 2005, he moved his laboratory to the Gladstone Institute of Neurologic Disease, where he is currently appointed as the senior investigator. He also holds appointment as a professor in the departments of biochemistry and biophysics and in neurology. He's an amazing guy. At the University of California, San Francisco, most recently, he was appointed as co-director of the Taub Korett Center for Huntington's Disease Research. And we'll be talking to him in just a minute. He's going to share the research that he's doing with us. And so what I'd like for you now in the chat room is to type in your questions, and I will get to them and ask Dr. Machowski for you. And we'll just take a quick break here, and we'll be right back after the HDV soundtrack. Dr. Paul Machowski. Welcome to the show, Dr. Machowski. How are you tonight? Dr. Machowski, how are you tonight? Dr. Machowski, how are you tonight? I think we've lost him. Hold on 1 second, folks. Sorry for the trouble here. Okay, can you hear me, Dr. Machowski? Okay, can you hear me now, Dr. Machowski? Dr. Machowski, can you hear me now? We're having trouble, guys, so I think, Paul, you can't hear me, or if you can hear me, I can't hear you. So I would say hang up and call back into the show, and then I will cue you in, and we'll try to get you your volume going again. So folks out there in the chat room, sorry for the inconvenience here. I'm going to have Dr. Paul Machowski call back into the show. We're having little gremlins, and... which happens occasionally, so give me a second here, okay, folks? Okay, he's going to call back in here in just a second. So basically, what we're going to be talking about is Dr. Paul Machowski has a lab at UCSF. Okay, here he is. Hold on, folks, one more time. Dr. Machowski, how are you?
Good.
Yay, we have him back. Okay.
All right.
Little gremlins happen. So how are you tonight? And welcome to the show.
Thank you. Sorry for the glitches.
Well, hopefully that won't happen again. But we have lots to talk about tonight, and we only have an hour with you. So let's talk about the studies that use yeast as a simple system to identify mechanisms. And why is that important for HD?
Okay, great. Well, thank you again for having me.
You're so welcome.
So, studies in my lab, one of the things that we did a number of years ago, actually when I started my lab in 2001, was we were looking for an unbiased system to try and find out essentially sort of molecular pathways that are important for Huntington's disease. In Huntington's disease, the mutant protein huntingtin is like really nasty and it does a lot of bad things. And we wanted to, rather than just guess what's important, use some system that would be unbiased to tell us what's important. And what we chose to do was use simple yeast cells. And, that might be a surprise for many in the audience. I'm talking about the same yeast cells that you use to make beer and wine and bread. And a lot of people might say, well, why would you use something like that to tell you something about brain disease? But the reason we chose to do that is that we had found that if you take the Huntington disease protein and put it into yeast cells, that it would actually make them sick. And that was really convenient because it allowed us then to do some screening methodologies that would allow us to find tricks, essentially, sort of genetic tricks that allow the cells to tolerate the Huntington's. So basically, we'd knock genes out of the yeast, trying to find genes that when we disrupt them would actually prevent Huntington from being toxic. And so we ended up doing that, on a very large scale. The thing about yeast that's surprising, I'm sure for many people, believe it or not, is that they're not that different than us at a fundamental level. So a yeast cell is sort of like a simple human skin cell in a certain sense.
Didn't know that.
So like all the machinery that you know is required to make a cell, the yeast actually have. And in fact, we actually historically learned a lot about biology from studies in simple things like yeast. And so the second reason that I thought this would be a really good idea was that at that point in time, it was one of the few systems that we could study basically every single gene all at once. So, for example, many labs use mouse models to study Huntington's disease. Well, if you want to study a pathway in a mouse model of Huntington's disease, often it can maybe take you almost a year or two.
That's brilliant.
And so in the yeast cells, you can actually study every single pathway all at once very quickly. And that's what we did.
What is the lifespan of a yeast cell?
Well, it's a few weeks, something like that. But the experiments we do, when you put Huntington into them, it kills them right away. So, within a day.
Oh, man.
So it was actually the actual experiment was a little bit tedious, but relatively straightforward. And so we did this experiment to ask, which pathways in yeast, when you disrupt them, are protective against Huntington being toxic. And from those studies, we found a bunch of interesting pathways.
Interesting. So how did you find the pathways? Did they... how do you discover that? Is it...
So that's a good question.
Microscope,
So yeast was actually the first organism that's a eukaryote that we actually sequenced the DNA of. So there's basically, when we did these experiments, we knew exactly which gene was disrupted. So as soon as we were finished doing what we call a screen, we knew exactly what pathways we identified in that. Because all the genes are known in yeast, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so we looked through that list, and then we said, well, which of these pathways might be important for Huntington's disease? Were there any that had any evidence from other groups working on it? Were there any that seemed like they might be in a pathway that you could treat with a drug? Questions like that.
Mm-hmm. So you're looking for therapeutic targets, right?
Essentially, yeah. Mm-hmm. In essence, that's what we're trying to do, find a therapeutic target that we could block or manipulate that we could then move forward and start doing studies, in other model systems for Huntington's disease. And so when all those yeast studies were done when I had a lab in Seattle, and then when I moved to UC San Francisco and the Gladstone Institutes in 2005, they really challenged me, essentially, to test whether these pathways might really have significance or not. And so in 2005, we started translating all those experiments actually into mouse models and studies in neurons.
And that way you can do a longer study, right? A little bit longer.
Well, yes. And,
not much
and the
longer,
thing,
but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the important thing was, if we believe that those pathways that we found in yeast would have any relevance for Huntington's disease, and if we wanted to move forward towards drugs and patients, it's essentially a necessary step to go through the mouse models. So, and unfortunately, it's a little bit painstaking, but that's so. The last 5 years, we've been trying to study the different pathways in mouse models and also in neurons and from the disease.
Right. Is that part of a requirement as well for FDA and all that, is that you'd have to do these?
Well,
incremental?
It depends, but by and large, yes. By and large, you have to, at this point, if you have something totally novel and you want to treat, you know, something that you totally came up with in complete novelty and you want to use it to develop a drug for Huntington's disease, you have to show that that will have a good effect in a mouse model for Huntington's, or sometimes even in two mouse models for Huntington's.
Oh, wow. And that's what takes a little bit longer.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not some of these testing of drugs in the mouse models takes almost as long as a clinical trial.
Mm-hmm. Can you test drugs in a lab, in a like a petri dish? Or?
Well, yeah, there are people who do those kind of studies, and I think they also have utility. But even if you identify some drugs, you know, in a petri dish that look interesting, you still have to test them in a mouse model, unless it happens to be an FDA-approved drug already.
Oh, uh-huh. Oh, that's an idea, too, is by using other drugs for other conditions like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. Do they have to go through clinical trial for Huntington's as well?
Well, you know, unfortunately, we don't also have any drugs that slow down Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease. There are some drugs that are used to treat the symptoms of it. So we don't know, but basically if it were to be a clinically approved drug, say for example that an arthritis drug worked for, we found out that it worked for Huntington's, then you wouldn't necessarily have to have a clinical trial, but it would have to be prescribed off-label. So in order to really get insurance to approve you know, using the drug, it would have to be a trial showing that it works in Huntington's disease. As far as I understand,
in order for the insurance companies to accept the off-label use of the drug.
Yeah, I've
kind of been through that gambit myself with some of the medications I've tried to use with Jimbo, because the insurance will only pay for, or at least Medi-Cal will only pay for the medications that are prescribed. For, you know, for what the drug is for.
That's right, yeah.
However, they do, you know, they do allow other medications to be used off-label, so it's kind of...
I think if we, you know, if there was a drug that really worked, they would allow
I would hope so, yeah, for sure. Okay, now your lab also performed and identified an enzyme called KMO. And what
was
that? What is that?
So yeah, so this is a good segue because this KMO protein, it's an enzyme called KMO, which is short for a complicated name called kynurenine monooxygenase. But basically, the take-home message here is that we've identified this enzyme KMO that we think is a potentially important therapeutic target for Huntington's disease, and we actually found that as a potential drug target originally in one of those yeast genetic screens that I talked about. So the yeast cells said, hey, this pathway is important for Huntington's, at least in yeast cells. So now what is it?
it's a long word.
And why would you think that something called KMO would be of interest for Huntington's? So it turns out that KMO functions in a very ancient metabolic pathway that we have in our bodies. And it's called the kynurenine pathway, and it's basically the major way that we degrade the amino acid tryptophan.
Ooh.
So some of the amino acids that are the building blocks for proteins, they're essential, meaning that we only take them up when we eat food. And then they're used as precursors for building blocks for proteins and a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. So this enzyme KMO plays an important role in one of these pathways. And the reason why we were interested in it was two reasons, basically. The first was that pathway, the kynurenine pathway that it functions in, had actually been thought to be important for Huntington's disease and other brain diseases based on some studies that were performed in the late 1970s and early 1980s. So there was a big literature that I ended up finding and, you know, I'd heard about as well, suggesting that this particular pathway, this metabolic pathway for degrading tryptophan, seemed to be abnormal in patients. in a way that might be contributing essentially to the demise of the neurons.
Yeah.
So that was one reason we got really interested in the finding, that blocking the pathway was protective. But the second reason that I was really keenly interested in KMO was the fact that big pharmaceutical companies had actually been working on developing inhibitors for KMO. And they were originally developing these as a potential treatment for stroke.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, you know, wow, how come no one's actually tested whether an inhibitor of KMO would be beneficial?
Interesting. So then what is that in relation to the... Because I saw an article in Gladstone News. It was a story about a new compound called JM6.
That's
is
right.
Is that related to what you're talking about?
Yes, yes, it is.
Okay.
So JM6 stands for... it's kind of a funny aside story, but my father's initials, Joseph Michalski.
Oh, that's great.
And it's number compound 6 that he made. So
My dad
was a chemist who worked for years and years at a company called Syntex and had a lot in drug development. And he actually has made himself 4 different drugs that are on the market.
Wow.
And what happened is... his company, Syntex, was bought out right around the time I started to work on KMO. And the company that bought him out had been developing, was one of the companies who was interested in developing KMO inhibitors.
Was
so,
that Syntex?
He worked for Syntex, but it got bought out by a company called Roche eventually.
Oh, Roche, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I tried to actually see if Roche would help us out and give us some compound that we could test in Huntington mice, but that proved to be difficult. So I actually ended up, convincing my dad to help us make some KMO inhibitors. And then what happened is we said, well, let's make our own KMO inhibitors. And so we decided to initiate an entire chemistry program to develop new KMO inhibitors that we hoped and still hope that we could take into clinical trials in patients.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
And so JM6 is one of the compounds that we've been working on that we tested in animal models. And so basically, you know, we spent several years working diligently trying to make a bunch of KMO inhibitors. And eventually we decided it was time to go ahead and test these and see if they do anything in mouse models of Huntington's disease and other diseases. And so what we ended up finding was that indeed JM6 showed some strong neuroprotective effects in a mouse model, not only in a Huntington's disease mouse model, but also in an Alzheimer's disease mouse model.
Ooh, double whammy.
Well, the reason that has significance is several fold, but one is that it suggests that it's just a pathway that might be important broadly for brain diseases and not be specific to Huntington's disease. But the second reason I think it's important is, as you're probably aware, it costs an extraordinary amount of money to develop a new drug. And essentially, you know, the more diseases that affect a lot of people that, for example, KMO might be associated with, the better chance we can get of big companies being willing to support it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so can we have your dad continue working with you?
Well, we are to this day, and have received some funding from the NIH to help do some initial safety studies on our compounds,
mm-hmm.
and those are ongoing, and, you know, we hope to be able to initiate formal safety studies and toxicology studies such that we could move into clinical trials in HD patients, you know, before too long.
Right. Now, we were kind of talking before the show started a little bit about treating whole body versus just the brain. Can you kind of describe what it was that you're trying to explain to me?
Sure. So, once the Huntington gene was identified, the gene makes a protein, and the Huntington protein, all the scientists wanted to determine very quickly, is Huntington only in the brain? And only in the brain region that appears to be most vulnerable in Huntington's disease, or is it everywhere? And the answer was, it's everywhere. It's not just in the region that dies, essentially. And so that's something that was known now for quite a number of years, but hasn't been really it hadn't been thought to be of significance until mm-hmm. recently.
Do we know if it starts in the brain and then goes out?
Excuse me?
Do we know if it starts in the brain and then goes out, or is it just...
No, it's just everywhere. Every cell makes it.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. You know, muscle cells, skin cells, immune cells, mm-hmm. bone cells, everything. And so people have started to ask, you know, well, does that protein do bad things to other parts of your body and other cells in your body? And also whether or not that might be important for mm-hmm. the deterioration of the brain. And at least in our lab, we've been quite interested in studies on the immune system and its potential to influence Huntington's disease. And really, that our interest in that area arose in part from our studies on JM6, and I'll tell you why. So the JM6, the compound that my dad made, that we saw seemed to be have strong neuroprotective effects in Alzheimer's and Huntington's mouse models, mm-hmm. It turns out that it didn't get into the brain.
Oh. Okay, blood-brain barrier, right?
That's right. So when we first got that result, it really threw us for a loop, and we were scratching our head. We were thinking, like, well, how the heck could something, you know, work without getting into the brain?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that took several years to sort out.
And how much better would it work if it did get in the brain?
That's another good question, and we don't yet know the answer to that.
Mm.
We're interested in answering that question for sure. Yeah. But what we found out was that essentially that the JM6 works by targeting chemo and blood cells and immune cells. And so what we found by a series of studies in animals that within minutes of giving an animal with Huntington's disease the JM6 compound, that very quickly this caused an inhibition of chemo in the immune cell, and that caused a signal to be sent up into the brain, like a molecular signal, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that molecular signal, we think, is neuroprotective. It stabilizes activity, neuronal activity in the brain, and slows the disease down.
Interesting. So it doesn't necessarily have to get in there.
That's right. Our suspicions are is that it might not have to.
Ooh, there's messages going on in there.
Well, this is exactly what we came to realize. Mm-hmm. You know, you could imagine that your immune system is an important conduit to the outside world, right? And remember, we were talking that this pathway that chemo functions in is actually involved in amino acid metabolism of something that you take in with your diet. So
mm-hmm.
so the idea basically is that there's these pathways that talk back and forth between the brain and the periphery all the time, and all we're doing is sort of hijacking that and taking advantage of it.
Yeah, I've heard other people say that there's a metabolic connection, you know.
Yes, yeah, that's something that...
and there's proof to it now, so...
Well, and that's something that I believe is... almost certainly playing an important role in Huntington's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people have known that there's metabolic changes in patients for a long time, including,
mm-hmm.
you know, most notably muscle wasting and
mm-hmm.
how Huntington patients have increased caloric intake, yet they still lose weight.
Right.
And
how alcohol really does damage.
Yeah.
Damage, right?
But you know, unfortunately, you know, it hasn't been as well studied of an area. So you know, people are starting to go back to the studies and metabolism and how that's influencing the brain and so on. But
mm-hmm.
but basically, you know, our results surprisingly showed that blocking this pathway in the blood cells has an effect on the brain. And so, you know, at that point, we thought, well, this can't be just a unique pathway. There must be other pathways in the immune
right.
cells that are also disrupted. And so we basically started looking very carefully at the immune system.
Yep. And all of the expression that happens in the cells is, you think, carried through the immune system?
Well, so the bad protein, the Huntington protein, it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that we wanted to ask is it doing something bad to the immune cells? And the second question we wanted to ask is, if it is doing something bad to the immune cells, does that make a difference for Huntington's disease or not? Does it make a difference for the brain degeneration?
Mm-hmm.
And all of our studies to date would suggest that both of those are true, that Huntington's doing bad things to the immune cells, and it's also disrupting pathways that are important for neurodegeneration, at least in mouse models.
So then what role does, sugars, or like you're working on yeast for research, but what if a person has an overabundant amount of that in their system? Would that have any role in degrading the immune system at all?
Well, I'm not quite clear that I get your question exactly, but whether nutrients...
who consume large quantities of sugar.
Okay.
That plays a role in the immune system, right?
Yes, yes.
Metabolically.
That's exactly correct. So it's actually what's best known is, it's kind of opposite what you see in Huntington's actually, but diet-induced obesity actually is associated with changes in your immune system that are thought to be important in driving a lot of it.
Mm.
So in Huntington's disease, I don't know the answer to your question, but what I would say is that, you know, what we eat and what we do and how that affects our endogenous bacteria and flora in our gut do have very important consequences for the immune system, just for everyone. And so if you're saying then, on top of that, that those immune cells have a bad protein like Huntington in them, that means they're not going to be responding to all the normal nutrients and microflora in the right way, or at least we think so.
Well, I've heard of HD patients craving sugars. You know, they crave the sugar, and I don't know if it's because their energy is low or if there's something else going on metabolically.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me that they would crave sugars and nutrients, you know, because, you know, at a certain point, what it looks like is occurring is that the body's starting to eat itself for energy.
Right. Okay, I have a couple questions here, so let me... Hold on, I need to copy them over. Just take a second here. Judy wants to... Mary Robertson, can you get this JM6 from any foods?
Unfortunately, no. So JM6 is basically something that my dad came up with in his own head and was a totally new small molecule, but it was designed so that it could be developed potentially into a drug or some, if not JM6, something similar to JM6. So, but no, they're not. It's not naturally found in foods.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then Judy Robertson is in the chat room with us today, and she's very supportive of you. She's a fan of Dr. Paul Machowski. She says, glad he'll be...
Well, I'm a big fan of Judy, so thank you.
She says, glad he'll be able to talk about this hopeful HD research to all of us. She also wants to know, we're getting to this, Judy, so hold on. She asks, Dr. Machowski, has anyone with HD been treated with a bone marrow transplant? And if yes, did it help?
That's another great question.
Thank you, guys.
Asked everyone I know that question, and I have yet to found someone that knows of a patient who had a bone marrow transplant.
Mm-hmm.
But the background on this is that for certain cancers, for instance, like leukemias, you can actually give a bone marrow transplant and it cures the cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, you know, would something like that have any benefits to Huntington disease patients, and that would it be worth considering? And so to begin to address that question, we decided to do bone marrow transplants in our mice, in the mouse models,
mm-hmm.
for Huntington's disease. And so we basically took two different Huntington mouse models, and we gave them an immune system that was normal, meaning that the immune cells didn't have Huntington in it. And what looked to occur is that it seemed to slow the disease down. So it didn't cure it, but it seemed to slow it down.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And so, you know, I've been asking all over the, you know, the world, every neurologist I've ever met that sees patients, and every family member. Actually, it would be great if anyone in the audience knows someone who potentially ever had a bone marrow transplant, because I'd love to hear the answer to that.
Well, that's a good question, because who knows, maybe there is someone out there with leukemia and HD.
You would think that it's possible, yeah.
And maybe the HD had been...
The only thing that's difficult is that, at least from the mouse studies, because when you do a bone marrow transplant, you know, the bad protein Huntington, you take it out of the immune cells, but it's still in the brain cells, you know. So so the best case scenario, I think, would be that you slow the disease down, because you're not, you know, affecting the brain. So if the immune cells are important, it's probably contributing, you know. So it might be difficult, like, you know, we've been talking about this, whether we should consider, you know, potentially doing a clinical trial or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the question is, how would we know whether it's really slowing the disease down or not?
Mm-hmm.
Which is always a difficult
question.
What would
the biomarkers be, and how would you, how would you record data that...
Well, there's one thing... and some really nice work done by a collaborator of mine named Sarah Tabrizi in London. She's taken blood from Huntington patients and also done some nice imaging studies in the brain. And all of her studies have shown that the immune system is abnormal in Huntington's disease, and it actually looks like it's activated. It looks like you have an infection, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And those studies also surprisingly showed that this activation of the immune system occurs really, really early. So, you know, sometimes decades before onset of motor symptoms like chorea.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, we don't know exactly what that means at this point in time, but it's unusual that to have a disease where your immune system's activated chronically, you know, for 10, 15, 20 years, you know.
Or, you know, since birth.
Yes, potentially. We haven't looked back far enough, yeah.
Looking back on, you know, my Jimbo's history, I mean, he was sick as a baby, a lot, all the time, you know.
Really, really, that's very interesting.
Yeah. Always, I mean, he had asthma and he was always sick, and everybody thought I'm a Munchausen mom, but I'm not.
Yeah.
And come to find out, he's got multiple genetic, you know, conditions and.
Yeah. So the reason we're interested in the immune system so much is there's actually drugs for the immune system. You know, there's not a, you know, an extensive list of drugs, but there's a number of drugs out there that treat certain aspects of immune system abnormalities that might be important for Huntington's disease. And so, you know, that's really our next steps, is whether or not some of these drugs will do anything in the animals, and if they do, whether they do the same thing in the patients or not.
And how would you determine if a person is, their immune system is activated? How do you...
Luckily, that is actually very straightforward. So it's just with a blood draw.
Mm-hmm. Like a CBC, or... Are there certain...
Well, there's basically, you mentioned biomarkers before, so there's protein biomarkers in the blood that you know, if you had an infection, for example, you see these things. They're called, the scientific name for them is called cytokines, but they're basically protein molecules that are signals, you know, to say that there's an infection. And again, those are increased in Huntington disease patients, and it's quite easy to measure. So for example, if we were to treat patients with a drug that would decrease their levels, you know, that would be very easy to establish. The thing that's difficult to establish is how much of an impact that's going to have on the brain disease.
Mm-hmm. Wow, this is such a complicated disease. This is something we were really talking about before the show went on live, is the fact that, you know, it's easy to do a blood test and say, oh, yeah, you know, you're HD positive, but then what? It's such a complicated disease in so many ways, it's impossible to treat, you know?
Yeah. I started working on Huntington's disease when I was a postdoc fellow in Germany in the late 90s. And, you know, at that point in time, people had just made, Jill Bates' group had just made the first mouse model for Huntington's disease, and there was just so much, you know, hope that we'd be able to really get at what's going on more quickly. And then it very quickly dawned on all the scientists that we're dealing with a far more complex disease than we thought.
Yeah.
And so now, you know, then essentially for the last 10 years, people have been very carefully, generally trying to study what's going wrong in the neurons, which made sense. I mean, those are the cells that die that are the most important. But you know, it was never, no one really thought that you know, other cells and tissues might be involved in Huntington's disease, I think, until the last few years.
Right.
So it's just an added layer of complexity, yeah.
Well, and then as the disease progresses, there's so many other things that happen in the body. Yeah.
Well, that's correct. And, you know, so one thing that the body generally is good at is adapting. And so, you know, you're faced essentially with, you know, cells that in a certain sense are like infected with this bad protein and are doing everything they can to hold on and fight it. And the hard thing about studying that is like a lot of the pathways and changes that you're studying are actually compensations, you know.
Yeah, and it's changing daily, you know, at some point. It's every
so could I ask, too, and another thing that I would love to hear feedback from, just generally from patients or families with HD, is you hear a lot that onset of Huntington's disease varies quite widely.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And yet, yes. Once you have it, you know, generally speaking, I think you know, the progression is pretty steady.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, for my interest with the immune system, I mean, why would onset vary so much? I mean, what's explaining that? And, you know, one of our ideas is maybe things like, you know, different infections might be triggering some of the onset.
Again, the immune system, right?
Yeah, and mm-hmm. So I guess my question is, you know, if the families out there, you know, who studied their affected family members, if they ever had any instances where they knew where they or they felt that you know, their onset or the strong progression was precipitated by infections.
Or events.
Like you hear also about like traumatic yeah. events or a car crash yeah. or things like that too.
Yes. Boy, that's a good one, because I know with my Jimbo, I keep talking about Jimbo, but he fell off of a wine tank, and that's really when it all started. I mean, when it really, the symptoms really began to progress rapidly. And, you know, he lost his balance, so he didn't have muscle, you know, strength or endurance, so he fell. The ladder slipped out from under him. He fell and landed about 15 feet.
Wow.
Onto a cement slab. So he, you know, after that, it was never the same. He was never
wow.
the same.
Wow. Yeah, you see, I've heard stories like that. And,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, those to me, you know, would really, you know, suggest that you know, I mean, what's going on when things like that happen? And there's strong
yeah.
changes to your immune system, for sure.
It's like the body is attacking itself. And here's another example. The dystonia started when he was given high doses of a medication that he was allergic to.
Oh, really?
So
wow.
now he's hyperactive to certain generics. He can't take certain generics. He is highly, highly sensitive to electrical fields. EMF.
Yeah.
Last week we had a thunderstorm, thunder and lightning, just tore him up. Horrible dystonia, and I don't even.
Wow.
I'm not a doctor, and I can't diagnose seizures. But throughout the whole night, he just lost it. You know, he just he was screaming in pain all night. from the electrical storm.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that.
It was horrible. But, you know, you try to tell a doctor that, and they look at you like you're freaking crazy, you know?
Yeah, well, that's the hard thing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, that, you know, as we sort of discussed earlier, you know, the question ultimately is whether, you know, Huntington patients might benefit more by seeing other doctors beyond just their neurologists, and it might be that it might be useful.
Yeah, true. We have a couple questions, and it looks like we have a caller. So let me see here. Judy Robertson wants to say, Dr. M, is there anything we, the HD community, can do to help you get the JM6 into human clinical trials?
Well, I would
say that money, right?
No, I mean, that's also an excellent question. The most difficult issue with having something new is all the safety and toxicology studies have to be done. And unfortunately, they're quite expensive. And that means, you know, if it's to move forward, someone has to pay the bill for that. And, you know, there's, you know, it's been challenging for me to try and find support to move those forward, although we have some support from the NIH for it. And, you know, I've been in discussions a lot with companies who are potentially interested, but no one essentially yet has pulled the trigger on it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if anyone had connections to good companies, you know, pharmaceutical companies or biotech companies or, you know, anything like that could help, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Another quick mention is, would it be beneficial to have people with HD and arthritis to look at? So if they have arthritis and HD.
I would be very interested in that, actually. Yeah.
Hmm. Okay, so if anybody out there knows someone with HD and arthritis, contact Paul Machowski.
And I could elaborate a little.
Yeah.
The reason why I'm interested in the connection to arthritis is that arthritis is also an immune disease where your immune system's activated. And what's known is that there's protein biomarkers in the blood of arthritis patients that go up. Those happen to be the same ones that go up in Huntington's disease.
Really?
And now there's drugs that effectively treat arthritis. One of them is called Enbrel. And made by Amgen. And you know, the question is if any Huntington patients have ever been taking Enbrel and whether or not it's helped their overall Huntington's disease beyond just arthritis.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like another study, right?
That one, I think is really worth doing.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it. Let me take this caller real quick. Hold on just a moment. Hello, caller, 714 area code. This is Melissa. Welcome to the show. Would you like to ask Dr. Machowski a question?
Yes, this is Carla Crow.
Oh, hi, Carla.
Hi
Welcome
there.
Welcome to the show. How are you?
This is hitting home for me very much. And I just, there's a couple of things. Yes, my daughter Emily, who we lost a couple of years ago, almost 3 years ago, she had a lot of urinary tract infections, a lot of anemias, a lot of sore throats, and ended up having to have her tonsils out. And we really noticed after she had her tonsils out, we couldn't get her awake. The doctor couldn't get her awake. So I'm also seeing that she started slowing down and having issues after the anesthesia, which we didn't know about, but I've heard about now.
Interesting.
So like after surgery, you know, with the juvenile Huntington's.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's something to look at, too. Also, she did crave sugars a lot. That was one thing I could give her that she really wanted. It's hard to kind of hold that back when they're losing everything else.
It's an interesting point you bring up, because simple things like response to anesthesia or how a patient might tolerate a drug hasn't ever been looked at, as far as I can tell, for Huntington's patients on a broad scale. So, you know, for example, Huntington's also in your liver, you know, so do Huntington patients, can they metabolize drugs the same way normal people do or not?
Right.
I mean, their response to anesthesia might be, you know, quite different than a normal individual.
Well, there really wasn't any option for her because she was sick all the time. And the only way we could stop her from getting sick was to get her tonsils out. Not even once thinking, that doesn't mean everyone that has their tonsils out or goes under anesthesia is going to have a problem. But she definitely, there was clearly we couldn't get her awake. The doctor couldn't get her awake. And it was unusual. And we noticed it. But we really didn't think about it too clearly because, you know, it took a while before we really saw it.
And you're also saying that in the long run, that didn't really help.
No, but we found out she didn't die of Huntington's disease, juvenile Huntington's. She did have it. She was adopted. Her birth father had that, but we found out when she went in the hospital with an anemia that was really major that she had hemolytic anemia, too. She had got that from her birth father, too. So she had two issues going on that we didn't even know about, the other issue.
Wow.
Was the hemolytic anemia genetic, or was that just diagnosed?
Yes. That was it's a blood disease, terminal, and she got it from her birth father. We didn't find that out. She basically woke up one morning all white, and her lips were white. She was half Latin, so when she was white, she was chalk white. And I rushed her to the hospital, and it took them 3 days or so to figure out with tests and stuff that she had this hemolytic anemia, which made, you know, she didn't want to eat. She was throwing up all the time. It was a nightmare. And she wouldn't eat the whole week she was in the hospital. So, but they found out she had both of them, and there, of course, there were no cures for either one of them. So, but we found out later her birth father did have it in his family. Her birth mother we have contact with, and she's in contact with friends of her birth father. So, yeah,
How did they diagnose the hemolytic anemia, Carla?
You know, they tested her in the hospital. I don't know all the ins and outs. My husband, Ted, might know more than me. He's actually watching the show or listening to the show now, too. But
well,
they did a lot of tests on her. Yeah.
Anemia is pretty quick to pick up in the blood test. And then the question of what's the cause of the anemia is more
complicated. Well, see, her face and lips were white. Her eyes eventually got jaundice, where they were yellow in the hospital. I literally had to take my glasses off. Keep taking care of her. I wouldn't leave her alone in the hospital because nobody knows about one of those diseases, much less both of them. And the nurses aren't going to stay with her full time, so I stayed there all week with her.
I'm sadly actually aware of anemia because once I had a major internal bleeding issue where I actually was hospitalized for a week because I lost all my blood. But luckily it was just a sort of freak thing. And,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
But that's exactly how you describe it, is exactly what happens, you know. I mean,
very scary, very sudden, you know. But she had a good attitude through the whole thing. The only thing is, with two terminal illnesses, you know, she just wouldn't eat. She wouldn't eat anything because everything she ate came up. And she just said, I don't want to eat. She was done. That's it, you know. So
okay.
I think she had been in pain for a while, and she never complained, ever. So, you know, I think she'd had other issues going on. She didn't tell us, and I knew. But, you know, I'm okay, Mom. That's the way she was. She was an angel on earth for sure.
Related to pain, that's actually another question that I've asked quite often of patients is, you know, if they believe that they have increased pain or not. Because that pain also has strong immune connections, and based on the activation of the immune system in Huntington's disease, you might predict that they might be hypersensitive to pain, but I don't know. I can't tell if anyone's ever looked at this.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of days before she died at the walk, our HD walk here in Southern California, she complained of the back of her legs hurting, and I remember that she never complained. But I told her to put her feet up, and we hadn't been walking that much, but I said, put your feet up on a chair and just rest them, you know, and she seemed to be okay. But, I mean, she's not a complainer. You know, she just did not complain much. But I could see, you know, she wasn't comfortable.
Yeah.
Moms always know those things.
I know.
Yeah.
It's hard. You don't want to push.
Yeah.
You don't want to push, but, you know, you feel it. But she'd say, Mom, I'm okay, so I just dropped it because I don't want to upset her on top of everything else, you know.
She was a HD warrior princess.
Definitely. Definitely. Unbelievable how brave she was. Unbelievable. Yeah, and she really wanted to get a cure. You know, she talked to researchers. We did everything we could with her. So definitely a gift for all of us.
You know, it's patients like her and your son that are truly inspiring to the scientists. I mean, I actually every year have my lab participate in the HDSA walks and also sometimes just go to the Huntington Clinic just to meet and talk with patients, because you couldn't imagine what a positive effect that has on stimulating research creativity and rigorousness.
That's the goal.
Definitely.
The goal.
We're keeping up this goal for our life until we get a cure.
Yep. We need a cure. We need to end HD for sure.
Yeah,
Carla,
thank you
so much for coming on and sharing with us.
Oh, I have to. You know that's my mission now, and my husband.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Say hi to Ted. Hi, Ted.
I will.
Okay,
Bye-bye.
Bye. You know, my Jimbo has excruciating pain all the time. It never lets up. It's constant. And then when the electrical storms hit, it's magnified. And when there's too much EMF around, it's magnified and goes into dystonia events. So, you know, I've heard kind of two schools of thought. People have pain and some people don't have pain. What is the factor that is causing the pain?
Well, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but that's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, of course, what I would say would be interesting to look at the correlations between their immune systems and, you know, whether one might be more activated or not.
I have some blood labs if you're interested.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pretty crazy. Well, how are you for time, Dr. Macheski? Are you okay for a couple
more
minutes?
Yeah, I'm okay. Yep.
Okay, good, because we still have a couple more things to talk about. If
sure.
That's okay with you, and if anybody has questions, type in your questions. We were talking about the camo and the jam sticks and the immune system. Now, and you're talking about the mouse model and the yeast model. Are there any other models that you're working with right now?
Well, I have done, not in my own lab, but as part of a collaboration with a former trainee, a lot of studies in fruit fly models. And and so, again, why would one think that using a fruit fly would be good for studying something like Huntington's disease? And the main reason is that, like, the yeast is just a very simple cell. It's almost like a skin cell. Well, the Drosophila, the fruit fly, it actually has a nervous system. So you can actually study whether a neuron dies or not. In a fruit fly that has Huntington's disease. So very often we will go from the yeast to the fruit fly to the mouse, just because it's, you know, the studies in the fruit flies are also quite rapid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe some patients know Leslie Thompson and Larry Marsh and that crowd at UC Irvine. They've also done some really beautiful work using the fly models.
Great. So how do you... prepare them? Do you breed them a certain way? Or?
Yeah. So they basically, just like the mice, you make little flies that carry the Huntington's gene, and then you just breed them.
Wow.
And then, you know, so for example, when we published our paper showing that blocking KMO prevented neurodegeneration in mice, my former trainee also published a paper at the same time showing that the whole pathway that KMO axon is very important for neurodegeneration than fly models.
Wow, interesting. And then you don't go any further than the mouse model?
Well, so at this point in time, there's not really other models that are really available, you know. So most the next step for most people in my situation would really be to go to HD patients. Having said that now there's groups trying to develop new models that are closer to us, like a pig model and a sheep model for Huntington's disease.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they're still being made and characterized, and you know, at this point in time, we're just pushing as fast as we can to go to HD patients.
Oh, that's good to hear. I know, HD is such a horrible disease, and we're, you know, the people who are dealing with it are suffering so horribly. They'll pretty much do anything to help, right?
To get
this moving. So
no, I totally agree. You know, I think that you know, ultimately, you know, what we'll probably see is a very likely scenario will be that, you know, eventually what, you know, we'll get a drug that works, and then you'll see a bunch of drugs eventually work. But it's, I think ultimately, the Huntington patient's probably going to be taking some drugs for their brain, some drugs for their immune system, some drugs maybe for their muscle degeneration. You know, I think it's going to be, there isn't going to necessarily, as far as we can tell, be a miracle drug at this point,
mm-hmm.
at least on the short term.
Right. Well, now, if people want to get a hold of you, can they reach you at the Gladstone Institute?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you can just Google my name, Paul Muchowski, and come up.
Okay. And he's at the Gladstone Institute, UCSF. Let me just break in with some announcements real quick. And was there anything that we didn't cover before I go into announcements that you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, I think that, you know, I think we covered a lot of different materials. So, you know, again, I would just say that, you know, if anyone wants to follow up on any of those questions that I had, mm-hmm. you know, feel free to contact me by email or calling me. I'm always happy to talk to patients. And yeah, just keep up, you know, the,
thank you so
the
much
good
for
faith
the work you're doing.
And participating, yeah.
Yes, we appreciate all that you're doing. And it sounds like you're on the right path here for us. So,
well, you know, I've mentioned this recently that, you know, having worked on Huntington's disease for a number of years now, we as scientists, you know, there's a lot more optimism recently than there has been historically. And I think because, you know, some of the things we're starting to find really look quite a bit more promising than before. Mm-hmm. And so, I think everyone's quite anxious of the sort of next wave of clinical trials. You know, in hopes that we're going to get the first drugs that actually work.
Right. Oh, wait. Looks like somebody has a quick question. Are there any foods that HD patients should eat to boost the immune system?
That's a good question. Unfortunately, that's not something that is well known, you know, in terms of what you know, in science and commonly accepted science practice. So unfortunately, I don't really have a good answer for that. But what I would say that, I don't really have a good answer. But my suspicion would be that eating mm-hmm. things like yogurts and things that have bacteria that are good for you, and it's
mm-hmm.
probably a good thing.
Anything that would correct metabolic issues and immune system issues, probably, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a very growing and interesting area of research in the immunology world, but it's not really well known what's going on. Mm-hmm. But like you mentioned earlier, you know, too much sugars and things can lead to obesity and diabetes and all these other
mm-hmm.
issues. And the wrong foods can have a remarkable effect on your normal flora that are in your gut, your gut bacteria, basically.
Well, and don't we know that, like, for example, alcohol can be a neurodegenerative property?
Yeah, certainly excess alcohol, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's a big one. You know, we have people in the chat room wanting to know, how can HD families donate to your work? Do you have a fund?
Well, we do have... together with my colleague, whose name is Steve Finkbeiner here at UC San Francisco and the Gladstone Institutes, a number of years ago, through the support of the Toby and the Corret Foundations, we established what we call a Translational Research Center. And we only have one goal for research in that center, and that's to move drugs into clinical trials, basically, and try and identify drugs that slow Huntington's disease down. And you know, if you Google, like, Toby Corret Huntington's Disease Center, there's a mechanism there whereby you could donate to the center, and that would go 100% to research to develop a, you know, drug.
And will that go to your research?
Absolutely. Yeah, it would actually...
Do we need to... say it's for Paul Muchowski's research?
Yeah.
Okay. So we can Google Tob Corret Center, Translational Research Center, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And what I can do for you folks out there that would like this information is I can post it on the show page once the show is done. I'll go and grab the the URL from the internet and post it so y'all can come back, check and see where you can donate to Dr. Paul Machowski's research. And we still appreciate what you're doing.
Great.
Don't stop.
Yeah, I'll just mention
please
quickly.
Don't stop.
So people, if they know, when Toby, it's actually spelled T-A-U-B-E, and Koret is K-O-R-E-T. So if you just do Toby Koret Huntington's, then it comes up.
Okay, and then we can call them and tell them we want to donate to your work.
Yes, well, that would be tremendous.
Okay, great. Well, we're going to do that. And real quick, we have a couple of upcoming shows. April 23rd, the JHDV with Dr. Pagnopoulos, University of Iowa. April 30, the HDV with Dr. Michael Geschwind. You know who that is, right?
I sure do.
May 7th, the HDV, ask Dr. Goodman. Hopefully she'll be back. I haven't double-checked with her yet on that, so that might be open. May 14, the HDV with Jimmy Pollard. We're going to be talking about nursing homes. May 21st, the HDV with Dr. Finkbeiner. We know him, too.
Yeah, he's my partner in crime.
Yep. And May 29, Health for HD News with Stu Blatt. He's a physical therapist. That's going to be an awesome show. June 4th, HDView. We're open so far. June 11th, HDView with Meta O'Rear. We're going to be talking about spirituality on that show. And we just want to tell everyone out there, thank you for tuning in. Dr. Machowski, thank you again for your marvelous work that you're doing.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to get an opportunity to share some of our research and talk about it with the community.
Well, would you like to be on a website with us?
Sure.
That's the next question, because I'd like to put you on my website and link you up to the Tupret Research Center.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let's do that. And if anybody out there has any more questions, please send them to my website, healthforhdinternational.org, and don't forget about the Health for HD app. You can get that also on healthforhdinternational.org. Find us on Facebook, Health for HD groups, and don't forget to look at we have a face.org and deshalmar.org. Check out the trailer. James Silvano, I'm sorry he couldn't be with us tonight. And I ask that you keep him in your prayers and his family in your prayers. And hopefully he'll be with us again next week. And we look forward to having a good show next week. Dr. Machowski, thank you again for joining us and for all the work that you're doing. We so appreciate you more than you know. And good night, everyone. Have a good night.
Well, thank you.
You something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Sidestep the little bits of history repeating.